is InfoCast 5000.
This is the podcast where we dive into the history of things familiar to everybody. Join us as we try to figure out what, Sam?
Why taxidermy exists.
This is Baron Malley, untaxidermied.
And Sam Acuff, also untaxidermied.
Are you sure about that, Sam?
Yes.
How positive are you?
I'm not full of rags and sawdust, and my bones haven't been replaced with wood.
I would like to debate you on that. But after the show, welcome to part three of taxidermy. What's going on with part three, Sam?
Well, last week, we took a look at the 16th and 17th century to see where practical taxidermy began following the death of taxidermy for a little while after ancient Egypt rituals became irrelevant. This brought us to the whimsical Victorian era where taxidermists not only pushed taxidermy techniques, but pushed the practice into new genres with the anthropomorphization of their subjects. But despite the opulence of sword-fighting mice on a grassy knoll, the craft had a ways to go before we get to where we are today, and that is where we are picking back up this week. So please join us as we continue to try to figure out why taxidermy exists. So despite the popularity of the potters and other Victorian taxidermists, the majority of the industry was still far less concerned with the artistic value of the specimens and more concerned with how they could more easily produce for the overwhelming demand of stuffed animals. So just to keep everything in perspective here, yes, there was the Great Exhibition of 1851. Yes, there was really top-notch, like setting the new standard for taxidermy specimens and this huge sweeping craze of Victorian-era taxidermy where there had to be particular care applied to these animals to get them to do these very human-like activities. You know, you couldn't have just like a rough and ragged, loosely stuffed sack of fur pretending to drive a golf cart or something, you know? Like,
they have standards.
But these were all not the mainstream of taxidermy. It was a huge industry still that had to, you know, there was a huge demand, so there had to be a huge supply. And most of these companies and factories just had, you know, they wanted to keep their bottom lines nice and fat, their profit margins fat. All the workers just wanted to punch their card at the end of the day. They didn't want to be there for 15 hours a day meticulously sculpting these taxidermied pieces. No one really seemed to want a need for these pieces. So we still have these grotesque, for the most part, like kind of generic looking animals. So the standard was still to aimlessly stuff animal hides and shoot for a ballpark likeness of the specimen, despite the fact that sort of information of what the likeness looked like was much more accessible by this time. Early Victorian taxidermists still stuffed mounts with sawdust and rags, which usually disfigured them. But to fill in some more of the grotesque details, the visual blanks, here's an account of what it was like to taxidermy an animal working in Henry J. Ward's workshop located in New York during the early 19th century.
The skin would first be treated with arsenic, soap, and strychnine. The bones wired and wrapped back inside the leg, and once hung upside down, the skin would be stuffed with straw or sawdust till it could hold no more, and then beaten to shape with a wooden stick.
Yeah, and animals were basically prepared for stuffing like a turkey. So what gave? How come when we go to a museum now, we don't see a bunch of morbidly overstuffed beach balls of fur that look like they got beat by a fucking stick? And for that, we can thank Mr. Carl Akeley. Akeley was born in Clarendon, New York in 1864 and grew up on a farm attending school for only 3 years. Because that's all you need.
To be a taxidermist at this time, probably.
Well, I know what I don't know, and that's all I need to know.
Congratulations, Mr. Akeley. You have passed high school. Go out and...
I'm only 6 years old.
Yep.
As a boy, he spent a lot of time observing nature in the woods behind his house and would paint pictures of animals in his own blood.
So...
That's not a bit. Yeah, he did that. Because he didn't have paint, Baron.
Some of these people just need a hug as a parent.
I think they found the healthiest outlet for their impulses, Baron.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
What do you think Marty McBlood Painter was going to do past age 6 if he wasn't stuffing animals? He was going to be stuffing you, all right? he found the best avenue for his proclivities.
That's a totally fair point. So you're saying we should just gather up all the preconceived serial killers now and just get them into taxidermy, and maybe that'll steer some of them in the right direction.
Saying it couldn't hurt.
I'm into it.
And at the age of 12, he ordered a manual on how to perform taxidermy from out of the back of a children's magazine. Lest we not forget how extremely toxic the chemicals were that were necessary for this process, by the way. But you know what? That's neither here nor there. Another kid in his basement where his parents just totally not giving a fuck that doesn't he's matter. Just playing with dead animals, all kinds of poison. And
arsenic and mercury poisoning had nothing to do with these people's mindsets.
No, this guy totally grew up to be a well-balanced and not psychotic individual at all. You know what? Maybe it's time for a check-in. If your 12-year-old kid is, I like to play with the dead ones.
Well, maybe if he wrote like more cries for help on the wall in his own blood, then
no, he's painting people... animals in his blood.
Well, see, that's the problem. Look, mommy, a couple more messages.
I drew a picture of you with me. He took several apprenticeships after that. After the age of 12, I think it was about 6 years. Yeah, because he was like, I think he was 18 when he took his first actual apprenticeship to learn taxidermy. First, he worked in one of those companies that I talked about, the interior designers, but that guy mostly did paintings. He occasionally needed taxidermy. Achille was a shit painter, but a great taxidermist. So he was like, hey, man, I don't think this is your gig. You should go to New York and look for a job, where he worked for another guy. And then eventually he wound up working for the aforementioned assembly line by Mr. Ward, because he was a part of like this big prestigious three-generation taxidermy family, which also speaks to like how long this industry was around, that there was a grandfather, father, and sons that all stayed in the taxidermy industry with all these factories popping up everywhere. While at Ward's, he felt like they weren't quite taxidermizing animals to his level of finish, we'll say.
I thought you were going to say murdery enough.
If you... No, they were all super into murder. That was a constant throughout the industry.
Oh, thank God.
But as we mentioned before with your brilliant reading, it was a factory line with a bunch of like what I call taxidermy bros just stuffing animals. Like, hey, man, we don't fucking ask questions. We just shove that shit in that goose. What is that, a goose? Is it a raccoon? I don't fucking know. I don't need to know. I just fucking put the hay in there. I put a couple googly eyes on that fucking thing, put it in a crate, boom, I'm gone.
Hey, bro. Hey. How many rags you lift in when you take the rags out to stuff in that dead animal?
40 fucking rags, bro. I'm up to 40 rags. Look at this. Look at these gains.
You drinking your protein when you lift it?
Nah, I'm eating egg yolks and butter because it's 1850.
I guess that's a suitable protein equivalent.
Yeah, just lard. Just eating lard. Lots of booze, too. So anyway, Achille was a bit of a sensitive artist amongst these guys. He had to work a 12-hour day, and part of his agreement of working there was that he got to stay late to do his own taxidermy, where he started to kind of practice his own techniques. The other taxidermy bros apparently didn't like it. They fucked with him. They threw out the stuff that he was doing overnight. It became pretty arduous for him. And then one day he fell asleep on the job, which was one of the rules of working there, is you couldn't fall asleep on the job. So he was fired immediately. So then in 1886, after being fired from Ward's assembly line, Achille moved on to working at the Milwaukee Public Museum, where Achille remained for 6 years, refining the model techniques used in his taxidermy. This is where he kind of came up with some of the most important for modern taxidermy techniques, including using a plaster and clay mold as the base. So he was unhappy with stuffing a sack of skin that was loosely stretched over a series of wires and wood or metal frames. He paid particular attention to the musculature and ligature of the animal, paid particularly close attention to their natural behavior to pose them in more lifelike poses. And so it mostly became that he was stretching the skin over these plaster and paper mache sculptures that he had created of the animal.
I must have the most accurate detail.
Yeah, well, it's more like,
it's what he said.
I must have the most accurate detail. Detail.
Is he Southern?
No.
Oh.
But I like to think of him as having that accent.
Okay. Without that thought process, you know, again, as an illustrator and as somebody who took a bunch of classes in like anatomy,
and that sort of thing, we probably wouldn't have that kind of attention to drawing anatomy and creating life likeness without people like him. You know, in the scientific community saying, no, it's Michelangelo, he doesn't have a bicep on his forehead, it's down on his arm, you know, like that kind of stuff.
What are you getting at?
You said that he was really into the anatomical detail, yes. whereas they weren't before. And so I made a parallel to that to like the Renaissance when they were still trying to figure out the detail, but they were drawing like the, you know, these.
Well, it's similar, only that I think it's yes, because the products evolved, but it's different in that they knew that there was musculature and ligature and they had the information to know that. But they didn't care.
Well, it's the same with these animals.
Because they were working for the weekend, Baron. No one had the passion that Achille did, apparently.
Yeah.
And he really pushed. Like, you know, there were people that saw his passion, his drive. And he was encouraged to leave the more harsher conditions of, like, the assembly lines in New York to go work for the, like, smaller, more, like, you know, like the Milwaukee Natural, you know, the Field Museum, which he did actually when he started making these banger ass fucking taxidermies. Ward decided that his termination of Ward's of Achilles' position was wrong and hired him back. And that's actually where he did one of his most significant pieces, where he was tasked. And it took him like 5 months to taxidermize P.T. Barnum's the elephant that died in a train accident.
Yeah.
Which God only knows how that turned out, because who knows what a fucking train accident does to an elephant.
Achilles should have pulled a pretty woman on him. That's all I'm saying.
On pretty board. Woman?
Yeah.
Like, oh.
Like, I'm too good for you now.
Yeah.
Bitch. Yeah.
I was in here a week ago making these these fucking sculptures. And now you want my sculptures? Oh, I bet you work on commission.
Yeah.
But probably more importantly than anything is his legacy he left behind, which was that taxidermy can be artful. And by being artful, it can be more educational by being more visually accurate. And he achieved this with the Achille method.
First, sculpt the detailed and precise 1/12 scale clay model of your man. Now that you have your vision fleshed out, create an armature using skeletal bones, wood, metal rods, wire, and wire mesh. Next, cover the armature with plaster and then clay. Meanwhile, sculpting the clay to accurately depict the musculature of your specimen. You then coat the clay model with plaster. Once dry, the plaster mold is removed from the clay in sections, which results in a perfect mold of the sculpted model. Paper mache pulp and supported mesh wire are then applied to the inside of the plaster mold, and when dried, produce a full-scale hollow mannequin in the exact form of the original sculpture. The mannequin is then closed with the original pelt and sewn up so that not a single seam is discernible.
Yeah, I also read that he even painted all the mucous membranes to appear wet. Like, that's the level of detail he went into.
I appreciate, as an appreciator of good taxidermy, I appreciate the pioneering that he did. Although it sounds like he was a weird fuck, but, you know, appreciate.
And you know what? I know, like, I was going to get into all of his African safaris. Like, he not only liked stuffing them, he loved killing them. The one teaser I'll put is that in 1 year's expedition alone, which he did with Theodore Roosevelt the year after he left office, he either killed or trapped approximately 11,000 animals in a year.
Well, they got animals to spare.
That's, right.
Yeah.
That's like an insane amount. Like, that's like multiple a day. And he didn't miss a day. Hashtag no days off. So I also do have to mention that he was not the first to use clay forms as a substructure, and there's actually newspapers in England that have credited French taxidermist Francois Kumba from the Royal Museum at the University of Turin. The paper reported that his magnificent taxidermy European elk at the Great Exhibition of 1851 was all but breathing and looked as if he were petrified in his own skin. The secret of Kumba's...
Probably was.
Jesus Christ. The secret of Komba's success was to mold an animal, his animal's frames in clay before casting them in paper mache and covering his casting in the original skin. I couldn't find any evidence of these two ever meeting or if they traveled in the same circles, but all I can say is there's very little on Francois, and that Achilles is credited as being the father of modern taxidermy. And I think that has just as much to do with how prolific he was and how much influence he had on the industry as it does whether or not he was the first to use sculpted forms as his basis or not.
Well, as we've learned in history, whoever makes it in the history books first wins the race.
Exactly.
Right? So...
And he's
it is what it is.
He's credited with most, if not all, modern variations of modern taxidermy, all the way up to like the 1980s. Like his methods practiced.
I would say
even now. Yeah, probably now. I mean, just the latest that I could find was 1980. They were still using all the way up to the chemical compositions. I mean, like now I think they have a little like different standards, like. They used arsenic soap
like,
all the
like
way up to the
1980s. Stuff that is not poisonous.
Stuff that wouldn't kill a baby by just being around it. But yeah, he has what I would argue is probably the longest lasting legacy than anyone that we've talked about today. If not him, then the people that have influenced him, yada yada. I mean, I think it's a good to fair chance that Francois Komba influenced him, even if it didn't come up in my research, because like what are the chances? And also having some experience in metal casting myself, it sounds an awful lot like the lost wax process, which is thousands of years old, you know, the clay to paper mache to it's mold making basically.
Yeah.
So it wasn't exactly his idea. He was just the first one to popularly apply it to taxidermy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. With all that being said, I would like to cap it off because you know, Ackley pioneered all these traditional taxidermy methods, which still apply today. But, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on in taxidermy today in the sense that there's two schools and one, even more than that, as we talked about before recording this, but we can probably divide them into like the artistic taxidermy and the super realistic mm-hmm. taxidermy that's built for primarily hunting trophies. I don't know if they still even use it for educational purposes anymore necessarily.
Well, yeah, no, I couldn't have said it better myself. So starting around the 1960s, there's a growing rejection in some national museums to either discontinue the collection of new specimens because of consideration of the loss of natural habitats of these animals, or to purge existing collections because they represent colonialism and are trophies of imperialist practices that countries like Britain and the U.S. have an extensive history of operating under. And you know, a lot of our topics, I know we talk about a bunch of old white dudes in Western society, and I think more fitting than any of our topics so far, I think that applies to this because taxidermy is basically the the epitome of Western culture kind of stealing from everyone else and appropriating stuff from everyone else and bringing it back home. And a lot of other cultures weren't doing this because it's superfluous and they weren't being shitty like we were being shitty.
I fail to see how some white dude sending back 15,000 leopards from Africa is an appropriation of anything.
I don't see a problem either.
Maybe you better backtrack that statement. That was a gaffe.
Hashtag not all taxidermists. Am I right? Also, the argument has been made that nostalgia should just be banished in general for the interest of greater usefulness for museums as space becomes sparse. If you collect dead animals for over 200 years, chances are you're running out of dead animal storage. In recent decades,
your warehouse gets filled up.
Yep. Okay. In recent decades, taxidermy has been critically reappraised as a historical and cultural object, by which I mean two things. First, the historical bracketing of taxidermy and the practices engaged in collecting and mounting animals. The second, an unraveling of the various cultural, political, and ideological forces that have shaped how nature has been used and interpreted within museums. And regardless on which side of the fence you're on these topics, this has driven modern taxidermy in several ways, as you mentioned before. The fact that taxidermy's value has been questioned within museums, first of all, means animals have emerged as an edgy medium for contemporary artists and enthusiasts of the macabre. Like, I don't know how many art buffs are out there listening, but Damien Hirst, fucking Mark Dion, or Thomas Grunfield, all are appropriators of taxidermized animals in their art for various means, usually hitting on what a lot of modern naturalists that criticize taxidermy bring to the table. That is, what is nature suspended in an artificial environment, like a man-made environment? Like, is it, you know, whatever. This isn't going to turn into like an artistic critique of
just
taxidermy, but yeah, juxtaposition,
smashing together of genres.
Yeah, it gives you a nice little bit of contrast, I guess. Another direction it has taken is the growing popularity of professional taxidermist competitions, where people combine traditional techniques and orthodox realism, like Achille, with more formal artistic presentations. So like a more realist, you know, it's like the equivalent of like figure painters versus like abstract artists, I guess.
You could even argue that there's maybe some hyper-realism movement inside of taxidermy, because there's definitely a hyper-realism movement in the art world right now. So yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that's the saying. I think that's the goal that they're heading towards in these competitions.
Yeah.
I perused the NTA, which I think is like the best representation of this. It's the National Taxidermy Association, and they hold competitions annually, and the 50th actually happens to be being held this summer in the Best Western Plus Romoka Hotel in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, if anyone was interested. Yeah. honest to God, if I'm in South Dakota or around there in that area, I'll fucking go. I did peruse their website a bit, and they're just beautifully done. They're just, extensions of the work that you saw coming from Carl Achille and his fans of his in the decades that of who came after him, of just these hyper real, really well preserved, but they're not, where it diverges from the more naturalist standpoint is they're not in their natural habitat in these competitions. They're cropped eloquently, you know, like it's like if it's a deer, they usually crop it like at the shoulder at an angle, like artistically, like for better sight lines, you know, like through the torso. Or I saw one of a wolf, and it was only like a portion of the wolf and a portion of his prey. Like they're curating it more through, I guess, like a more poignant lens of like trying to look at a specific moment. And there's like a lot of these very eloquently sculpted wooden bases and such.
It's a portion of reality, or a portion of the aesthetics that they want you to see. It's built to be a very pretty representation of.
Yeah, it's a showpiece. Yeah, it's like the best show model of a dead animal you could imagine.
Right.
Yeah, and there's a kid's.
I would drive it home. I would lease it, put some insurance on it.
And there is a kids' competition too, in case you were worried. So there's young Achilles everywhere.
Yeah.
And out of curiosity, I did look up their like bylaws of ethics, and you do have to prove that all the animals were like harvested.
I bet you do
legally.
Oh, okay.
So like if you bring in, like there were tigers in the exhibition last year, one of which won like an honorable mention, which seems like a lot of work to get a tiger corpse, to get just an honorable mention, you have to provide paperwork that the tiger was brought in not by a poacher and all this shit.
If I was a judge of a realistic taxidermy competition and somebody brought in a tiger, I would automatically judge him lower, because you're obviously just trying to drum up points, because tigers are more shockingly aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, get out of here, you fucking tryhard.
Yeah, like... exactly.
You're a taxidermy fanboy.
Exactly. So in contrast to all this, there's another movement going on in contemporary society, which is still based off of, I would argue, Achilles' methods that he pioneered. And in deep contrast to all of this, and I know I said that already, but there's another aspect to that, in the sense that this realism taxidermy is largely male dominated, whereas what I'm going to be talking about, which is a rogue taxidermy artistic slant on taxidermy in general, is all women dominated, and the numbers are grossly
slanted in one direction or another. I would say as much as like 90% either way, which
you're not picturing a bunch of like women at this National Taxidermy Association.
They aren't into it, but that's also, I think, largely because the realism taxidermy competition is,
it's least, a safe bet to say that from what I saw, it's mostly dudes.
Well, sure. But what I'm saying is like, I'm asking the question why and part of that I think is a lot of these realism taxidermy competitions are based off of like deer that have been hunted or because I don't think anybody really develops taxidermy for education anymore necessarily.
Well, you know, you don't know that.
I don't know that for sure, but I don't think it's as big as it once was for sure.
So it's funny you say that, and not to derail you, but the argument for questioning the need of taxidermy in modern museums is because with the advent of like the television and internet, there's no longer this inaccessibility of exotic animals or just nature in general. Like you could flip on Discovery Channel and get everything you need to know about tigers.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So I'm saying like people, I don't think, and we could verify this in the dirty bits, but I don't think people are going out and shooting like, you know, lions out in Africa to collect for the Natural History Museum anymore. I don't think that's happening.
Well, there's a counter argument that there's just no substitution for being in the presence of these animals either. So you could go both ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read a brilliant essay that I'm going to credit in Dirty Bits that was clearly slanted toward a need for taxidermy.
Made a good argument. Yeah, the tableaus of virtual reality.
No.
Oh, okay. So anyway, but you have the basically these two schools. You have this realism in taxidermy, and then you have what they call rogue taxidermy.
Man taxidermy.
Yeah, you got the man taxidermy.
Man taxidermy, where we talk about like steaks.
Yeah, they talk about bear steaks and
talk about our nuts as we stuff fucking ducks.
Yeah. and then you have this rogue taxidermy, this artistic slant on taxidermy, which you mentioned a couple male artists, but it's largely dominated by women. Largely. Which I thought was interesting. Like I said, we're talking like 90%, but at least 70%, you know?
70% women?
Yeah.
Well, not to get nitpicky, but is this more like what kind of art are we talking? Are we talking like lo-fi, like lowbrow art? Are we talking like folk art?
I mean,
because like Damien Hirst is kind of, and I'm not being to put him on a pedestal, he's kind of played at, wow.
Oh,
whoa, Sam, did I just go there?
Settle down, settle down.
You know, he's like Jeff Koons level. He's just like, you know, are these rogue taxidermists, really?
Yeah, okay. But I would say, I mean, it's still fringe. It's still out there. And actually part of the reason for that is like, I was reading this Vice article about these women and it's not totally accepted. And people are still shocked by the fact that women would be interested in this sort of thing. And that has led to a lot of hate mail and a lot of discrimination on these women. Yeah, seriously.
Who has that kind of time on their hands?
People
and who's writing these letters?
That show up to the Capitol on January 6th. You know who you are. But anyway, so
you can't be stuffing animals if you got a vagina.
That's pretty much it. Because there's this cultural expectation that women need to be this nurturer. You know, and there's still like these pervasive thoughts in, you know, typically white male incel dominated circles where the woman needs to be like the housewife.
You're shooting a lot of fucking shots here, my man.
Yeah.
You are.
But I think that's where the discrimination comes from, right? It all stems back to one fucking source, and that source is like an incel motherfucker on 4chan, you know, pissed off at women.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but I think that the kind of taxidermy that a 4chan user is doing is not the same taxidermy.
It's that same kind of mind thought that
I'm saying there's a lot more fleshlights involved in his taxidermy.
Let's hope so. So we have this rogue taxidermy movement that's heavily influenced, I would say, by this Memento Mori Victorian school of thought with this obsession with the macabre, and but also this playfulness with the macabre as well, because mm-hmm. you're so familiar with it, you're embracing death, and that sets it apart from this super realism that's being created in this traditional taxidermy sense in contemporary taxidermy.
And it's very much supposed to distract you from the fact that they're dead.
Is it?
Because it's very much supposed to capture.
I think it depends.
No. I'm saying that the hyper realists.
Oh, right.
You know, the realists are still trying to make them look as alive. Although the ones that are like vivisected for artistic effect might be a little harder to suspend our disbelief. But at the end of the day, yeah, they're trying to make them look real, doing natural animal things, you know?
Right.
Whereas it seems, and you sent me that picture, you just showed me that picture where the one's like playing a banjo or something on a chair.
he was reading philosophy.
Which is so silly because
it was a goat reading philosophy.
Goats don't play no banjo. Yeah, and I was just silly banjo goat.
But this could come in any number of ways as we're talking about. So maybe the creature is made up of several different animal parts, which encapsulates a personification of an idea, or a fusion of mechanical parts, which could be this comment on technology within the natural world. These chimeric depictions are created partly out of necessity, which is an important aspect of rogue taxidermy, being that it is a completely ethical, artistic form. So the animal was not killed by the taxidermist at all, and a lot of times their medium comes from roadkill, and sometimes with roadkill, you gotta put
some work material. With what you got, baby.
Yeah, you got to work with what you have. Maybe you got to put a clockworks in where its liver used to be because its liver was crushed by an 18-wheeler.
You're not making an android, Baron. It could just be like an apple.
Well, there's actually a lot. There's a big rogue taxidermy movement with like the fusion of mechanical parts.
Like steampunk?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll send you some pictures.
Steampunk playing a banjo. If you... You know what? Are we describing the lineup of Mumford & Sons right now? Is this happening?
It's... Why did my first thought go to the Chuck E. Cheese anthropomorphic band?
They're all taxidermized anthropomorphic animals.
I wish.
They went extinct with the dodos.
I wish. Well, they did.
The six-foot mouse? The six-foot t-shirt-wearing guitar-playing mouse?
Yeah.
Yeah, we drove them to extinction, just like the dodos.
We did.
And the last remains of them are in the Chuck E. Cheese's spread across the Midwest.
From what I read, like I said, this is mostly female-dominated, and I don't want to lay this line across the board saying, like, all women are like this, but I was trying to figure out, like, why is this mostly female-dominated? I'm going to explore some of this more in Dirty Bits, But the first thing that came to mind was that for you to have these hyper-realistic animals in the male-dominated world, you know, hunting is a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Women don't normally hunt. Some women do.
You're going to get them.
Women don't.
We're going to get so many,
hunt.
So much hate mail, man.
I hope not.
No, there's tons of women hunt.
Tons of women hunt, but more women are not into hunting.
You do. Bah, 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 bah.
This is all coming from alternative articles that I read that gave me the ideas to say these things. So, you know, write to Vice and tell them.
Blame the sources. Just double down. Dig in, man.
But they were saying like women have more of a nurturing sense about them. And so one could argue that, you know, although taxidermy isn't necessarily normally coincided with nurturing, you could say like you're still caring for the body in some way by turning it into a beautiful art form. There's
what a
definitely
traditional cis fucking thing to say. You scum.
There's definitely this delineation there. Well, I think the important line here is like rogue taxidermy is all ethically sourced.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also because, you know, we live in a planet that's freaking dying.
Dying,
right now.
Yeah. So, not to put too fine of a point on it, but I think what you're getting at is like it took us all of our existence as a species and all of our time of being fascinated with stuffing the dead to maybe consider not killing to stuff the dead. And it may have taken a movement primarily composed of women to have that idea. Well, that maybe we don't have to destroy nature to preserve it. Perchance is that what you're getting at here, Baron?
Yeah, I think that was beautifully put.
Thank you.
Actually, yeah.
It took two PBRs to get there.
But it's interesting because, you know, without Ackley and without the Potters and these growing environmental concerns, we don't have this fringe taxidermy movement, which is more related to what those early Victorians were doing in their tableaus.
So I know we got to wrap it up, but this is just my last final thought of, I would say that I think it's also the spirit of people like Ackley that do kind of have that nurturing aspect about them, because he did care enough to, despite his misguidedness, and I'm not defending the fact that he was personally responsible for many, many genocides of species, but he cared enough to not just have them push through an assembly line and stuff to Ignazium.
He cared about something.
And he, well, you know, I have so much about him, but I know, you know, for time's sake, I had to cut it short, and I will talk about him in dirty bits. But part of the motivation of a lot of his African safaris was a genuine concern, as misguided and ill-informed and ignorant as it was, or not, maybe, because of the way that we went with the dodos and other species. But he was very much concerned that future generations might not know what some of these animals were, because anyone that had enough money in the 19th century, typically for leisure or to get in on the taxidermy boom, would go to Africa to hunt to Ignazium, bring back as much as they could, and either put them in their own houses because of the naturalist, you know, the enthusiasm of naturalism, or to sell. And he was quoted of even saying that he wants future generations to know what hippopotamus look like. So he went out and killed a bunch of hippopotamus so that his grandsons can know what they are. And as misguided and fucked up as that is, I think it has seeds of the same kind of like caring for nature and like a desire to preserve it in this really backwards, fucked up way that only like white dudes from the 19th century could impose on others without their consent.
I mean, yeah, we're talking about really deep down shades of gray within the morality of the whole taxidermy movement and what people cared about and what they didn't. I'm sure that Ackley himself did have motivations that he thought were important and that he loved.
He had a heart. He had so many hearts.
he had
tons of hearts.
And they were all stuffed with sawdust and clay.
But yeah, I guess what I was getting at, or not what I was getting at, but what I just came to in my own head was the rogue movement. Those artists are kind of doing the more pragmatic, more literal execution of the kind of balance that people like Achille were probably trying to strike, but didn't know how to get out of their own, the product of their times, like get out of their own cycle, or didn't care to.
I'm not sure what you mean by balance, because it seemed like Achille, if Achille was alive now, he would be siding with the realists, I feel like.
No, not necessarily.
You don't think so?
He, I mean, God, this is slowly turning into a whole Achille podcast, but he had a change of heart partway through his career that like he was wrong in killing so many, and started working towards creating nature preservations. There's even rumors that he put it in the president's ear to start the National Parks Association here in America as a way to, because he truly believed that it was a just cause to preserve nature through the means of slaughtering nature. And I think it was also through this idea that there was an abundance of nature. We didn't even really start understanding that species could go extinct until the very beginning of the 19th century.
Those goddamn dodos.
No one gave a fuck about the dodos, dude. Those poor motherfuckers got wiped out of existence. They came and went. It didn't even dawn on us for like 100 years that they were even gone, dude.
So everybody, that's our journey through taxidermy. Of course, we're going to be doing a Dirty Bits. We're going to get a little bit more into this rogue taxidermy. I think we're going to talk about some interesting things that we left out of this script.
I'm going to have to talk more about Achille now, because
might have to.
You've had nothing but questions for him, about him.
It wasn't me. I'm just, you know, if we're using him as a contrast point,
it
to
is
everything
just
else,
us two in this room, Baron. Who else was asking the questions?
I don't even remember.
It wasn't Gumby the lion. That's for sure. Gumby doesn't talk. Gumby's not allowed to have an opinion.
Gumby.
Like, why do I got these big block teeth in my big stupid head, Baron?
Gumby. Why is it when I wake up in the middle of the night, you're sitting in the corner of my room, staring at me?
Gumby's lonely.
Gumby
needs love. Gumby needs a dodo.
Speaking of love, what's our social media situation?
InfoGas5000 on Instagram. Give us a look. I've been doing a really terrible job of keeping up with it. Hopefully by the time this airs, I've turned that around a little bit, but keep checking in. Maybe that's the fun of Instagram, is checking out when I'm going to actually post something.
Like, let's face it, we suck at social media, guys.
But we don't suck at recording podcasts and telling the truth.
We do our best, I would say. Yeah, we are working on a website. We just need to figure out what the hell we want on the website, and then we should be good to go.
And then we need to figure out what a website is.
If you have some interesting art to send either of us, it doesn't have to be InfoCast based. I just want to see your art.
And please, please subscribe. And if you like this podcast, tell a friend and see if they like it too.
And one more thing. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please go and give us a rate. Hopefully it's a good one, and we'll get into more searches. And then we won't have to do as much social media, because other people will be doing it for us, and it's great.
And one more thing, if you're going that far, just leave a fucking review. Why don't you?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
You said a rate.
Well, that's, you have to leave a review.
Rate and review.
Yeah.
And one more thing. I love you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.